Milk is in the middle of the news this week. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shvetta Jordan. Our feature story today is about the positive impact the newly popular Greek yogurt is having on the region's milk market. And just when business is looking good, many dairy farmers are kissing their cows goodbye. Perhaps not literally, but we'll find out why. This plus notable transitions in the environmental community in Pennsylvania and in Pittsburgh. And our commentator, Ken Chiacchia, weighs in on the new film version of The Lorax. You'll get no spoilers from me here about what he thought. That and more is coming your way on the Allegheny Front. Please stay tuned.
Attention, fans of all things south of the border and the Allegheny Front. We invite you to join us next month for a fundraising fiesta. The party takes place on Tuesday, April 17th at Mad Mex in Shadyside, and all proceeds go toward bringing you the best environmental radio coverage north of the border. So be sure to sneak in a siesta on April 17th so that you can party with the Allegheny Front all night long. For more information and to purchase tickets to our Bueno Buffet, visit AlleghenyFront.org.
Yogurt has always been associated with good health. Now demand is growing for a new kind of yogurt, the Greek variety. Sales more than doubled last year. And just as this market shift is healthy for consumers, it's also healthy for dairy farmers, a key sector in our region's economy that's been struggling to survive for decades. The Allegheny Front's Nancy Cohen reports.
Some describe Greek yogurt as tangier and less sweet than the conventional, but 23-year-old Matt Locke, who's shopping at a Giant Eagle supermarket just outside of Pittsburgh, says the taste has nothing to do with why he's sworn off conventional yogurt.
Flavor difference? I wouldn't say that there's too much. There's a lot more texture to Greek yogurt than regular yogurt. It's got more body and it's almost creamier than regular yogurt.
Other converts, like 50-year-old Julie Falvey, says Greek yogurt fills her up with the right stuff.
I like it because it's got more protein in it and keeps you fuller longer. So if you have it for breakfast, it's like eating an egg in the morning, basically, that same amount of it. And it's low calorie also.
It's got a lot more protein, double or even triple the amount that's in conventional yogurt. That's because Greek yogurt is made with a lot more milk.
This is raw milk right from the farm.
That's Tom Moffitt, president of Commonwealth Dairy in Brattleboro, Vermont. He's standing next to a 7,000-gallon tanker truck of milk. His plant makes yogurt for retail stores who want their own brand. Moffitt says he's getting nearly 50,000 gallons of milk delivered every day.
Part of the reason why we're receiving so much as a yogurt maker is because we make a lot of Greek yogurt. Greek yogurt takes about 5 times more milk to make than conventional yogurt.
Moffitt says when he first opened his plant about a year ago, he thought he'd be making maybe 10% Greek yogurt, the rest conventional. But as he steps into the room where conventional yogurt is made, it's clear a Greek tsunami has drowned it out.
This room's empty. We don't use this room very much because we don't make too much conventional yogurt. So this is probably the least used room in the plant right now.
In another room, Moffitt leads the way up 2 flights of stairs to a catwalk that overlooks 6 stainless steel tanks, each full of 8,000 gallons of skim milk that's fermenting.
The most important room in the plant in my mind, this is where we make the yogurt.
This is where the milk is cultured. But to become Greek yogurt, it goes into a centrifuge that separates out the whey, the watery part of conventional yogurt.
So that's what makes that Greek yogurt so thick and smooth and creamy. You're taking all the liquid out of it. So we're going to open this up and you can see the fresh Greek yogurt that's just been made.
But making such a rich yogurt requires more milk, 2 to 5 times as much. Moffitt says he can't always get enough.
Getting milk is a daily struggle. I mean, every week we put in our order for our milk in terms of how many tankers we need. And every week we sort of scratch, claw, and fight for as much as we can get. And I would say 3 out of 4 weeks, we don't get enough milk. 3 out of 4 weeks, we simply can't get enough raw milk into our plant to make the yogurt we want to make.
Sometimes the milk is there, but processors don't want to pay extra for it. In nearby New York, there are 29 other yogurt plants, many of which make Greek yogurt, also vying for milk. PepsiCo just announced it's opening a $200 million yogurt plant there. In Pennsylvania, Schreiber Foods in Shippensburg is making Greek yogurt. Besides yogurt makers, milk bottlers, cheese butter, and ice cream makers also want to buy milk. Penn State dairy economist Jim Dunn says when there's not enough milk for yogurt makers, this is good for farmers.
The fact that more milk is being used means that farmers everywhere in the United States, Western Pennsylvania, California, you name it, are going to get a higher price for their milk.
A USDA economist estimates the milk price paid to farmers in the Northeast has gone up by about 6 cents per 100 pounds of milk. Dunn says this adds up.
It basically means there are more farmers in the future than there would be without these new products.
Back at Commonwealth Dairy, a machine is pumping Greek yogurt, the consistency of soft serve ice cream, nonstop.
This filler is making 90 cups a minute of 2-pound cups of Greek yogurt, so it's using about 630 pounds of milk a minute. That's a lot of milk.
Moffitt says he doesn't see an end to the demand for Greek yogurt or the milk that's needed to make it. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Nancy Cohen.
Sorry, ice cream, I'm dreaming of a different dessert. Pink berry shaved ice and frozen yogurt. It doesn't feel like I'm cheating when I'm eating it, because it's healthy. I feel better already. Tart and sweet, fresh and airy. Blue and black, straw and raspberry. Succulent mango, tangy kiwi or pineapple. Popping up, swirly and fluffy, exquisite dream. Sorry, ice cream, I'm on my way to pink berry.
Now, from increased demand for milk to decreased supply. Thanks to the Marcellus shale industry. Researchers at Penn State found a big drop in dairy production in areas where gas drilling was heavy. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more on how gas is squeezing the milk industry.
Tim Kelsey is an economist and the study's lead author. He compared a USDA dairy survey in 2007 with one taken in 2010.
I was surprised by how large the numbers were. On average, it was almost 19% decrease in cow numbers in milk production in the counties with the most drilling activity, compared to a statewide decrease of between 4% and 6%.
The numbers are unambiguous. More wells mean fewer cows. But the results beg a bigger question.
What we don't know from the data is exactly why. Why are the cow numbers and why is milk production dropping?
Some theories? Farmland is being taken out of production by well pads and pipelines. And some farmers have reported contamination of their land. But there's another reason that may explain the drop-off.
One of the stereotypical phrases I've heard people say is millionaires don't milk cows.
Simply put, it's a hard way to make a living. If you can afford to give it up, why not?
So, you know, with dairy farming, there really is no vacation time. It's every morning, every evening, you got to feed the cows, you got to milk the cows. Unrelenting, day after day, week after week.
Rich Bednarski gave up dairy farming 2 years ago.
This is where we milked cows.
The milking barn at his Washington County farm stands empty. But for 33 years, he milked his family's cows here, every day, twice a day.
Through the summer when you was baling hay, you get started baling hay, and then you had to stop for milking. Then after you was done milking, finish it. And you was just totally rushing around.
With milk prices low and fuel costs high, Bednarski barely broke even. Some years, the farm cleared only $15,000. So when he got his first royalty check, Bednarski decided to sell the herd. He said it felt strange when the trucks came to load his animals and take them away.
But once the cows got to going, I thought, this feels pretty good.
A good feeling for Bednarski, but businesses that rely on farmers like him might be feeling something else, says Kelsey, a pinch.
It very clearly has an impact on some of the businesses that provide services that farms need, such as milk haulers, feed mills, large animal vets.
And if these support businesses go away, that's bad news for other farmers who still milk cows, says Kelsey.
It means the remaining farmers who want to stay in production, they're not able to operate as profitably anymore. They either have to do without supplies or they've got to travel a farther distance for supplies and repairs.
But newfound wealth might only be part of the story, says Kim Seeley. He's a dairy farmer in Marcellus Rich, Bradford County, and he's president of the Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Agriculture. He blames government policies with running small farmers into the ground. Marcellus wealth, he says, is really the final straw for these farmers.
It is the, you know, pushing the gas pedal faster at the end of a bad long cycle.
Lovers of local milk, yogurt, and ice cream don't need to panic at this news. Most of Pennsylvania's farming activity is in the southeast part of the state, and those farms don't have gas from Marcellus Shale. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from Table Magazine, sharing food culture and lifestyle in western Pennsylvania. The spring issue includes stories on unexpected cancer-fighting foods, earthy-inspired art from western Pennsylvania, and a fresh catch of local trout. Table's column, Our Food Environment, focuses on new strides in sustainable design. Table Magazine's spring issue is on newsstands now. More information is available at tablemagazine.com.
A new website aims to connect Pennsylvania's booming natural gas industry with local small businesses. An industry group, along with several economic development groups, unveiled Marcellus on Main Street this week. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
Speaking to members of the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce, Marcellus Shale Coalition President Catherine Klaber said local businesses can use the directory to gain a foothold in the gas drilling boom. Pipeline construction is just one example.
There's a lot of midstream gathering infrastructure yet to be put in place. So the last number I heard was around 700 wells that have been drilled but are not yet delivering gas to market. And in a lot of those cases, that's because that gathering infrastructure has not been tied up to go from the wellhead to those larger trunk lines.
Klaber also focused on the supply chain that would be needed to support water deliveries and new construction projects. One participant said his large engineering firm has hired about 60 new workers due to Marcellus development. I'm Susan Phillips for State Impact, Pennsylvania.
State Impact, Pennsylvania focuses on energy issues in the state. Go to the Allegheny Front website and click on the State Impact link for audio and more.
One of Pennsylvania's leading environmental organizations has left her post. Jan Jarrett had been with the Harrisburg-based Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future for 23 years since the organization was founded. She served as president and chief executive officer since 2008. She's being replaced by Penn Future senior attorney George Yugovich Jr. He's the former Southwest Regional Director for the State Department of Environmental Protection. While Penn Future described Jarrett's departure as a resignation, Penn Future spokeswoman Jean Clark says the board had been discussing a change of focus for a while. Clark says the new focus involves a renewed emphasis on legal work. Here to introduce himself and shed some light on some of these issues, George Yugovich joins me by phone. Congratulations on your new role.
Thank you.
Tell me about yourself, I guess. Are you a Pennsylvanian?
I grew up in actually Tom Corbett's home area of Shaler Township and went to Penn State and later to Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland, Oregon. Eventually, after clerking for the Ninth Circuit, returned to Pennsylvania because, ironically, I wanted to work in the environmental law field, and I had to go where the pollution was at the time to get a job because that's the states that had primacy for most of the major federal programs and had geared up their state agencies to employ persons.
But what era are we talking about here?
Not the 1920s. Mm-hmm. No. Mid-80s. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was fortunate enough to get an offer with DEP up in Harrisburg, actually.
You worked for the DEP for 20-some years? Or
On and off in different positions, and then, you know, I had left at one point and came work for Penn Future for six or seven years, I think, and then went back to DEP.
So how would you say your work with the Department of Environmental Protection will inform your leadership with Penn Future?
Most of the time I was with the department, I, of course, worked on as an attorney, both in civil and criminal contexts, and I tend to use that training to support my work here, ensuring that our organization develop policy positions and legal positions that are based on good science, good fact, and enforcement of the environmental laws that are designed to keep our environment clean and to advocate for clean energy.
You are not the first CEO of Penn Future, of course, to have a connection with the DEP. John Hanger led Penn Future for a decade before becoming the director of the department. Now, he was often maligned by environmental groups for his stance on various issues. Does this give you any pause as you take the helm of Penn Future, and how will you handle it?
It excites me. Anytime you take on complex issues and develop a nuanced position on those issues, and that's what I think complex issues demand, not black and white positions, but positions that are well thought out and well balanced, you're going to run into conflict with other persons that have other positions. And, you know, that really, in my view, is immaterial, because it is those divergent viewpoints that are going to drive sound policy for Pennsylvanians as a whole in terms of protecting the environment.
Your designation as CEO comes a few months after Jan Jarrett accepted responsibility when Penn Future was accused of misusing a state grant. Does your replacement have anything to do with that conflict?
No.
You've been quoted as saying Penn Future will emphasize its core mission of protecting Pennsylvania's environment in boardrooms and, if necessary, courtrooms. Do you think Penn Future has moved away from that mission in the recent past?
You know, in terms of our mission and refocusing on that mission, it has more to do with the political and economic climate and the climate for our environment. Environment has facing new challenges in this year and in coming years than it faced 4 years ago and that it faced 8 years ago. You know, we saw most recently the impacts of the dumping of untreated shale water into the Allegheny, in the Monongahela, in the Ohio rivers, and that raised the TDS dramatically in those rivers before that dumping was largely discontinued. That issue did not even exist in Pennsylvania 8 years ago. So we're refocusing our mission because we think we need to develop more discipline in order to be more effective in our core mission in protecting the environment. I mean, we are not focusing on Marcellus Shale per se. I personally don't really care who the defendant is or if they are violating the law, and our mission is to protect the environment. And one way we do that is to bring citizen suits to enforce the law when the agency that's charged with enforcing that law fails to do so. Then whether it's a trucker, a hospital, a municipality, or a gas company, that really doesn't matter to us. It's more about how significant is the environmental impact, whether the legal case will set good legal precedent, and how significant the public benefit is that could be derived from a successful case.
Do you think that the Marcellus has kind of eclipsed other environmental issues that need attention, such as alternative energy, growing greener, state funding, and coal issues?
Yeah, it really is a great question. I mean, certainly it's Marcellus Shale, you know, all day, all the time, right? You know, I guess I would have to, you know, agree with the suggestion. The shale industry certainly deserves attention, and has potential to be, you know, a great booster for the Pennsylvania economy. But it also, like any other industry, has the potential to have environmental impacts. And you know, our goal is to ensure that those impacts are managed in compliance with the law.
Follow-up question. There's a blog posting about your background today written by Susan Phillips at State Impact Pennsylvania, the public radio reporting project. Mm-hmm. She described you as more of an industry booster than a crime buster because she says you told an oil and gas industry paper that you had only positive experiences with gas drilling companies. Is that accurate?
I have had a lot of positive experiences with gas companies as they first entered the state. I don't know what that means other than I had a lot of positive experiences with them. You know, does that mean they have their industry has no impact on the environment? No, of course it doesn't mean that. Does it mean I also didn't have disagreements with them as we sat across the table trying to negotiate better control standards to be used on their internal combustion engines at compressor stations? I did that. And I did that as a regional director, and I thought that the agreements that we reached in large part benefited the public and the environment. People grow, people change, people fill different roles. Mm-hmm. My role right now is to lead Penn Future, and I'm going to do that best of my ability and maintain a focus on our mission.
Thanks.
Okay. Nice talking to you.
I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan with the Allegheny Front. I've been speaking with George Yugovic Jr. He is an attorney and now the head of Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future, or Penn Future. Please stay tuned to the Allegheny Front. The Penn Future transition wasn't the only change in environmental and public health leadership this week. The man who bore the brunt of criticism about persistent air pollution problems in Pittsburgh, Dr. Bruce Dixon, lost his job. Dixon headed the Allegheny County Health Department for 20 years before the board voted him out this week. That department is responsible for regulating air pollution standards. Penn Future had been calling for Dixon's resignation since last year. Tiffany Hickman, Western Pennsylvania Outreach Coordinator of Penn Future, explains why.
We were very displeased with how he handled the Allegheny County Environmental Task Force, their recommendations for how to improve the air quality program here at the Health Department. He was very lax in implementing some of those recommendations. We were not happy to see that. He was quoted last year as saying we could have the air quality of Montana if we didn't care about jobs. And that is a really toxic mindset for Allegheny County.
Hickman says that clean air needs to be part of the jobs discussion for Allegheny County. Before the board voted Dixon out, more than a dozen people spoke publicly on his behalf, including well-known forensic pathologist and former county medical examiner Cyril Wecht. But the board's vote was unanimous. There was only one abstention due to a member who was not present at the meeting. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported that the ouster was orchestrated by new county executive Rich Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald issued a statement saying that, quote, "It is now time to take the department in a new direction and to ensure that our public health, air quality, food safety, and other critical services are among the best in the nation." Dixon could not be reached for comment. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan.
Under the trees, happy dappy barbaloots. Under the trees, in our barbaloot suits. Under the trees, eating truculent fruits. Boldly succulent, mellifluous. Deliciously mellifluous. Sweetly succulent-luous, truculent fruits.
Summertime's a-coming.
Under the trees.
When The Lorax, Dr. Seuss's environmental cautionary tale for young readers, came out in 1971, it generated immediate controversy. It's been targeted for removal from school bookshelves. It even spawned a would-be corrective tale, The Truax, straight from the logging industry. Now, Universal Studios brings us a movie based on the Seuss story. Commentator and young adult fiction author Ken Chiacchia gives us his take on the new film.
The disclaimer. I am a Dr. Seuss fan. Green Eggs and Ham was the first book I read on my own. Even before that, my favorite bedtime ritual was Dad reading me Bartholomew and the Oobleck. But I never felt that The Lorax was Theodore Geisel's best work. It wore its heart on its sleeve. It always seemed a bit preachy. In many ways, I've thought of it as a learning project for him, on his way to creating the magnificent Oh, the Places You'll Go. Plus, when The Lorax came out, I was 9, almost exactly halfway between being a Seuss reader and a J.R.R. Tolkien reader, and way too old and sophisticated for such baby stuff. Still, the original Lorax comes across like Moby Dick compared with the new film of the same name. This is not exactly irony. I've struggled to write about some of the same issues Geisel presented to young children, though for the far easier adult and teen readers in my case, and I continue to be in awe of his chops. It isn't so much that the new movie aims low as it aims where Hollywood always aims these days. I'm trying to figure out whether the movie is the Phil Spector arrangement of the Dr. Seuss tale or the Universal Studios theme park ride. Like Spector's famous Wall of Sound, that booming background you hear in early 60s Motown songs, it's impressive, even a bit overwhelming. The Lorax's visual inventiveness is undeniable, especially in 3D, and it very nearly succeeds on that basis alone. It also is, figuratively, a good ride. When it turns to Hollywood-style action, it's in its sweet spot. If they aren't already building the literal ride in Orlando, they will be soon. That's the problem. In the end, the movie tells us more about Hollywood than it does environmentalism. Case in point. In the original, the villain, if you can call him that, is the Onceler. The narrator within the story, the hermitical Onceler, tells a young boy of how he destroyed the Truffula tree forest. He's a deeply ambivalent character. He's done something terrible, but he's as much a victim of his sins as anyone. We feel as much sympathy as anger. We are the Onceler, let's face it. The movie's creators predictably found that too complex and added another character to be the one-dimensional bad guy, the convenient other at whom we can all point a self-righteous finger. They also spun the ending. In the book, the Onceler gives the boy the last Truffula tree seed to plant, but the Lorax's warning, unless, hangs in the air, and we aren't really sure how it ends. I won't be a spoiler, but let's just say the movie folks don't think you can handle as much ambiguity as Dr. Seuss presented to early readers. The movie has other flaws. The stock romantic and good guy, bad guy add-on stories often come across as what they are, filler, and the plot drags at those points. But I'm more concerned with what the movie gets right. The action, the eye candy, draw our attention away from the story's heart and soul. I don't know that a kid who watches this movie will get anything nourishing out of it. The moral comes across as heavy-handed, and at best I suspect that it will provide a 15-minute environmentalism that's forgotten as quickly as a candy bar. It seems as if Hollywood can only tell us one story these days, and your kid can get that story from most movies. If you want something to build green young minds, go back to the Dr. Seuss book, or at least the original TV treatment.
Allegheny Front commentator Ken Chiacchia has published several speculative fiction short stories for young adults. This piece about the Lorax film is his first movie review for our program. That's the Allegheny Front for this week. Thanks for listening. We've randomly selected some of our newest Facebook fans to join us on the airwaves and visit our studios. You can see a fun video of us selecting the winners by going to our Facebook page. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh. Drop us an email sometime at info@alleghenyfront.org. Joey Spehar is our production director. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments. The Colcom Foundation and the Richard King Mellon Foundation support coverage of Marcellus Shale issues.